The Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act, or JOBS Act, became law in April of 2012. Intended to make it easier for businesses to raise capital, the JOBS Act can have some pretty meaningful benefits for the private equity industry. This is the initial installment of our podcast series on the JOBS Act and the private equity industry, and today we're going to talk about the improvements made to the IPO process by the JOBS Act. My name's Josh Bonney, and I'm joined by my partner, Joe Kaufman. So, Joe, who can use the new IPO provisions?
Thanks, Josh. The key to accessing the new IPO provisions is attaining the status of Emerging Growth Company, or EGC. And there are a few different tests that you have to meet in order to establish that. The key test is one based on revenues. And you look back to your most recently completed fiscal year, and an EGC is required to have had less than $1 billion in total annual gross revenues during that fiscal year. And that's that's the test. If you had $1 billion in revenues in prior years and for some reason went under, I suppose that's not great for business, but for purposes of qualifying as an EGC, it's fine. And so that's sort of the key test. You take a look at the revenues and see whether you might potentially qualify. But that's not the end of the story. There are some other requirements. Most notably, you can't have had any common equity securities sold in a registered offering prior to December 2011. Well, what does that mean in reality? Well, I think we all know an IPO, that would qualify. So if a company has gone public in an IPO prior to December of 2011, then they wouldn't be eligible to be an EGC. However, you could potentially get caught in this rule by some other methods, such as if you had to file an S-8 registration statement for an executive compensation plan and issued awards under that plan. If that S-8 were on file prior to last December, that would also trip you up from being an EGC. There's some question, and it's particularly applicable to the private equity portfolio companies who were previously public and have been taken private as a result of LBOs, as to whether they'll be eligible to be an EGC. And based on the guidance that the SEC has given out, I think that there is some question as to whether or not a company that was public, taken private, and is now going public again will be eligible. But it's probably something that needs to be analyzed on a case-by-case basis.
Sure, and it may be as technical as whether the entity that actually is seeking to go public as an EGC is technically the accounting successor of the company that had been previously taken private. Now, Joe, I noticed that you said common equity securities very precisely. I mean, what if I'm what if I've become subject to SEC filing obligations because I did a back-end debt exchange, and so I'm making my SEC filings, but I haven't actually ever sold any common equity securities. Can I actually still be an EGC?
Yeah, the good news is the answer is yes. If you're a voluntary filer, a debt-only reporting company as a result of covenants in your bond indenture, that's not going to disqualify you from being an EGC. It's only based on common equity securities. So the extent that you're looking to do an IPO and are a debt-only filer, and you otherwise meet the test, that'll be fine. There are some rules in terms of EGC status that do relate to debt, however, that could disqualify you. The key provision being that during the previous 3 years, an issuer cannot have issued more than $1 billion in non-convertible debt securities. Some clarification on that. First, we're talking about debt securities. We're not talking about bank debt or under credit facilities. You'd only look at it at bonds and notes and other types of debt securities. In terms of a back-end exchange offer, the SEC has clarified that if you do an AB exchange, you don't have to double count the amount of the debt. And then the third point is that it's not based on total amount of debt securities outstanding at any one point in time. Rather, you look to the total amount issued during the three-year period. So if you issued some notes and then you did a refinancing, you would need to count both of those in terms of the billion-dollar threshold.
So we spent some time talking about who is an EGC and sort of benefit from these reforms to the IPO process. But let's talk a little bit about what they are. Among the big benefits is going to be the ability to process your IPO filing with the SEC staff confidentially. So what that means is that you can get your registration statement together, and instead of publicly filing it on the internet with the SEC, you can submit it to them confidentially and go back and forth with the comment letters and the amended submissions without having to be in the public glare. The rub is, though, is that you will have to publicly file the registration statement and all of the previously submitted confidential submissions at least 21 days before you want to start your roadshow.
Yeah, I think that there's going to be some interesting discussions around that 21-day requirement. Obviously, in this era of market volatility, you know, 21 days before the launch of a roadshow can be a lifetime. But I think you're basically going to have to see where you are when you get a comment letter, see where you want to be in terms of launching your roadshow, and you know, be a discussion with the issuer, the underwriters, and their counsel in terms of whether you think you're close enough that it's time on this next amendment to effectively you know, bring the IPO out of the dark and go public with your filing to start that 21-day clock ticking.
I think that's right. There'll be a lot of sort of tactical judgments to be made at the time.
Yeah. Can you do a confidential submission other than in an IPO?
Well, you can. But it has to be before the IPO. So if you're doing a follow-on offering after the IPO, you're not available to you to use confidential submission. But on the other hand, if you qualify as an EGC and you, before your IPO, are filing an S-4 for a back-end exchange, for example, you could do that confidentially if you wanted to. You know, there you wouldn't expect that there'd be a roadshow, so the requirement to publicly file the registration statement and any of the previously confidentially submitted submissions would kick in, so that had to happen 21 days before you actually seek effectiveness of the S-4.
That makes sense. And what about the comment letters, right? I mean, currently comment letters get released in an IPO, but it's only it's a few weeks after the effectiveness of the registration statement. Does that change?
It does not change. If you're an EGC, your comment correspondence back and forth with the SEC staff will eventually go on the internet, but it won't be any earlier, any later than it does today.
Yeah, makes sense. Another area where being an EGC is helpful compared to the current process for an IPO is the ability to test the waters. You know, if you're a non-EGC, there are severe restrictions on the ability to go out to investors and have communications about an IPO and whether or not that investor might be willing to invest in the company in the IPO. Very strict restrictions in terms of having any of those communications before the registration statement is on file. But even after a filing, in many cases, you're not going to have those communications until the roadshow is formally launched. But if you're an EGC, the Jobs Act sort of throws that out the window and permits you to have oral and written communications with certain institutional investors either before or after the filing of a registration statement in an effort to determine whether, you know, those investors might have an interest. So clearly there's a lot more flexibility, and for a company who may not be, you know, 100% sold that an IPO at this point in time is the way to go, the ability to perhaps have a handful of those conversations might prove to be very helpful.
I think that's right. But this is an area where, at least, you know, my expectation is that we're going to have to wait and see a little how market practice develops in terms of understanding what people are going to do. You know, my own sense is going to be that people are going to be particularly careful about what written communications they use when testing the waters. I know the staff has sort of, you know, made clear that they may well ask to have those kinds of materials eventually provided to them during an SEC review process.
Yeah, the SEC may ask to see them, and just because under the Jobs Act these communications are permitted doesn't mean that they can be made without any concern about potential liability. So that's why I think if they happen, it'll have to be a joint determination between a company and its underwriters. They can determine whether or not it makes sense to do so, and I think you'll probably see it, if it happens, more often to be oral communications rather than written.
So we've talked a little bit about the process advantages of being an EGC in the IPO process: confidential submission, testing the waters, but there are also some substantive advantages in terms of the level of disclosure that needs to be included in your IPO prospectus. Generally, can be boiled down into two buckets. You know, there's some advantages in terms of reduced disclosure that's required in terms of the financial information and also around executive compensation. I think most folks know that today when you do an IPO, you need 3 years of historical audited financial statements and 5 years of selected financial data, and you may be required to present up to 3 years of historical audited financial statements for businesses that the IPO company may have acquired shortly before the IPO or is intending to acquire around the time of the IPO. If you are an EGC, you will only be required to present 2 years of historical financial statements and 2 years of the associated MD&A and 2 years of selected financial data and no more than 2 years of acquired business financial presentation, which, you know, I think is actually a pretty big benefit. I know, Joe, you and I have talked about before how sometimes it can be incredibly frustrating when you're trying to get an IPO done and sometimes the company just simply doesn't have the records to go out and generate that 5-year-old selected financial data.
Absolutely. You know, when you think back to sort of organizational meetings for IPOs, that always seems to be one of those issues that if you're affected by it, can be a real time delay in terms of having to go and recreate financial statements going out to years 4 and 5, or in the case of an acquired company, having to find somebody and finding those records in terms of having to provide 3 years of financials. So having the flexibility not to present those certainly is a big advantage to being an EGC. Now, do you think that we're, in all cases, going to see EGCs filing the bare minimum, the 2 years of audited financial statements?
I don't think so. I think if companies have the 3 years of historical financial statements and, you know, the numbers look good and the trends look good, yeah, I think most folks will probably just say, you know, the heck with it, we'll put it all in.
I think that's right. I think it, where it's not available, that certainly you have the flexibility to do it, but where it's available, you're probably going to see more than 2 years.
Now, one other thing that you know, we thought we'd mention in the context of this presentation on IPOs, although it's not really so much an IPO issue, is that as an EGC, the benefits to you don't just stop with the IPO. They continue for so long as you retain your EGC status as a public company. And one of those benefits is that so long as you remain an EGC, you're not required to have your independent registered public accounting firm attest to your internal controls. You know, and I know that many folks are focused in on this because of the cost issue. It can be incredibly costly to go through the process of, in essence, auditing the internal controls in addition to auditing the actual financial statements themselves.
Right, and the current rule is once you do an IPO is you do get one free year. Your first 10-K doesn't require the auditor attestation under Sarbanes 404. But in this case, if you're an EGC and you can maintain that status, that goes all the way up to potentially 5 years, which is a big benefit. The other area where being an EGC is extremely helpful in terms of reduced disclosure is in the area of executive compensation. And I would think that the discussions you have at the kickoff meeting about financial statements, the other area which can be a real area where there could be timing delays is in the preparation of a full-blown public company compensation section. And anybody who's reviewed a proxy statement knows what those have turned into, often going on for 20 or 30 pages or even more, including the relatively recent new requirements on needing to prepare and present a very detailed compensation discussion and analysis section, or CD&A, that very carefully describes a company's compensation philosophy. Well, the good news is if you're an EGC, you don't have to present a CD&A section at all, and you also can reduce the rest of the compensation disclosure as well. You still have to have a summary compensation table, although rather than having 5 people in it, you only have to have 3. And then with respect to many of the other tables that are required to be presented in that section, those can be eliminated as well. So it's really going to substantially cut down on the amount of disclosure that will need to be presented in your IPO prospectus, and as long as you stay in EGC going forward for up to 5 years, which is a big advantage.
Yeah, I think in terms of avoiding the brain damage to put the disclosure together, it's obvious that it's going to be beneficial to the company, but I actually think it could be beneficial to investors too, because it can be painful getting through those 30 pages.
Sure, and also frankly, your compensation philosophy are going to change once you're public, and so I've always questioned how significant it is to investors to go into painstaking detail about a compensation philosophy as a private company that really is probably not going to be consistent going forward.
So we've talked a little bit about the benefits that you get as an EGC, but there is going to be some additional disclosure that would be required In an IPO prospectus by an EGC. The staff has made clear that a company that is an EGC and is relying on those benefits in connection with its IPO, or that may rely on those benefits, is going to have some additional disclosure, and they're going to have to disclose the fact that they are an EGC right on the cover page of the prospectus, and they'll have to include some risk disclosure that alerts investors to the possibility that the level of disclosure that they'll be receiving will be, you know, a little bit reduced from what it might otherwise have been the case.
Do you think this is going to be a marketing issue for people, or are people just going to, you know, sort of take it in stride?
My own sort of guess is that the required disclosure regarding EGC status is rapidly going to become very standardized, and that investors are just going to flip past it without getting too concerned.
I think that's right. The last topic we wanted to discuss with you today relating to EGCs and the implications of the Jobs Act on the IPO process are the changes in the Jobs Act for that ease restrictions on research analysts that are affiliated with underwriters in an IPO. Previously, and for non-EGCs currently, there are restrictions on the ability of research analysts who are affiliated with the underwriters in an IPO from publishing their research on a company for 40 days following the completion of an IPO. So you sort of have this quiet period, so to speak, where you know, the analysts who are probably some of the largest and best known analysts in the industry are prevented from publishing research. Well, for EGCs, the Jobs Act removes that restriction, and at least in theory would enable the research analyst to publish, you know, during a roadshow, during the pendency of an IPO, immediately after the IPO. My sense is that for liability reasons, you're not going to see analysts publishing guidance during the roadshow or 2 or 3 days after the IPO. But I do think you will see a period much shorter than 40 days evolve in terms of their going out and trying to get out there with their information into the marketplace, which is beneficial. The second area where the Jobs Act changes the rules in terms of the ability of research analysts to participate in an IPO, under current FINRA regulations, you cannot have meetings with an IPO issuer involving both the investment bankers and the research analysts at the same time, and under the Jobs Act, that prohibition is eliminated so that you could have meetings where they're actually in the room. And I think the hope is that by doing so, it'll streamline some of the needs to hold multiple meetings on diligence and the like, where you're having sort of a diligence meeting with investment bankers, and then you're turning around 2 days later and having the same meeting, same presentation for analysts and repeating yourself. So I think that's certainly a benefit. Again, those are only for EGCs. If you don't qualify, you're going to have to stick with the existing prohibitions and rules relating to research analysts.
Yeah, candidly, I've always found some of these internal requirements at the banks as to who can be in the room at the same time as somebody else to be sort of Byzantine. So anything that can improve that and make the process a little more efficient has got to be a welcome thing. Well, thanks very much for joining us. This was the inaugural installment of our podcast series. Shortly, you know, hopefully in about a week, we're going to put out another one that's going to focus in on the impact of the Jobs Act on portfolio companies that are SEC reporting, whether because they've done an IPO or because they have are a debt filer or even a voluntary filer. And we're also going to talk a little bit about some of the benefits to portfolio companies in terms of the ability to stay private, even if the number of their shareholders has crept up.
Thank you.